It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered. I'm home.
You're like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, my God. We're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
God, this dialogue is shit.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and fight me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Solo Monster. Who are you to doubt El Dandy?
Woo!
Happy 4th of July. This is episode 711 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for July 4th, 2021. It was suggested to me that I take the weekend off for the holiday so that episode 711 could drop next Sunday on 711. But you know me, we don't take weekends off around here. I will say I'm disappointed. You know, today the new WWE Icons documentary on Lex Luger was supposed to drop. Timed perfectly with the July 4th Stars and Stripes Challenge from the USS Intrepid, which I'm going to get into in the history section a little bit later on. But I saw the trailer for the Icon special. It looks really good. And then all of a sudden, all of the teasers and all of the mentions of it on social media and on their YouTube channel got pulled. And apparently the special is not dropping today. It got pulled, it got delayed, supposedly because they want a stronger lead-in for it. So maybe they'll try to time it maybe with a pay-per-view, maybe Money in the Bank. I don't know. They don't have any new date scheduled, but it looks good. So I'm hoping we don't have to wait too much longer to see it. Happy birthday to the best there is, the best there was, and the best there ever will be. Bret Hart turned 64 years old on Friday, the day after Canada Day. Until this week, I had no idea that he shared a birthday with Larry David and Lindsay Lohan. But nobody could make me believe he was truly getting his ass kicked and taking a beating in a match more than the Hitman. All the little things that he did, I have come to appreciate his body of work even more as I have gotten older. But this is the 4th of July, and that means that there is a 4th of July sale ongoing right now on ProWrestlingTees.com. You can save 20% on all Sound Off shirts in our store when you use the code USA at checkout. Just go to ProWrestlingTees.com/SoloMonsterSoundsOff. You got to type in the full name of the show. Believe the sale goes through tomorrow, Monday, sometime around 1 p.m. Eastern, I believe. So if you want to get 20% off, that is the place to go. And if you'd like to make a PayPal donation, you may do so on thesolemonster.com. You'll see the PayPal button on the right-hand side of the page. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. And I got to say, happy birthday to Max the Axe Velado, who is celebrating a birthday this weekend. Drinks on me, he says. What a guy. It's his birthday, and he's the one buying the drinks. But Max, happy birthday. You've been a great friend of the show for a long time, and I wish you nothing but good things. We've got the Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton, Night Stalker, Nayef Al-Safar, Big Bear, Brian Becerra, Killshot, Keith Hart, Beast Mode, Brock Joseph, Evil Dose, Jeff Lippman, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichert, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, the Wichita Workhorse, Clayton Nettleton, Raging Mad, Mr. Raging Mad himself, John Raging Mad Riffle, Ostentatious Alan Carter, New York Punk, Arnold Modesto, the 90s Vampire, Eddie Valens, the Firebomber, Craig Foster, Michael Maximum Pain Palkowski, the Pastor of Pain, a lot of pain going on here, the Pastor of Pain, Damian Ewell, Belt Fan, Brent Banner. This week on the How Did We Even Get Here podcast, Brent and Trey discuss dumb things that start arguments in relationships, how they used to react to those dumb arguments, and how they react now. That plus the FU of the week and good vibes only. The show is available on 13 different audio platforms and YouTube. Just search How Did We Even Get Here on your favorite platform, or you can go to YouTube. The link on there, it's tinyurl.com/gethere-tube. And also, Ash. Shout out to Ash of the Schlock Tactics podcast, which is a monthly bad movie podcast talking horror, sci-fi, action, blockbusters, and B-movies. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and all major platforms. Their most recent episode covered Roddy Piper's performance in Hell Comes to Frogtown, which, having seen Hell Comes to Frogtown, I can attest, it is a terrible movie. It's No They Live. But badder is better. The Schlock Tactics Podcast. Check it out. Del Wilkes, better known as The Patriot, passed away early Thursday morning after a massive heart attack at the age of 59. And right before the 4th of July, no less, we lost The Patriot. WWE issued a statement. WWE is saddened to learn that Del Wilkes, known to fans as The Patriot, has passed away at the age of 59. Before making a name for himself in the squared circle, Wilkes was a standout on the football field for the University of South Carolina, where he earned the distinction of being voted a consensus All-American. After making the switch to sports entertainment, Wilkes competed all over the world before arriving in WWE in 1997 as The Patriot. A superstar quickly on the rise, The Patriot proudly donned the red, white, and blue of America in the midst of a rivalry with the Hart Foundation, leading to a memorable match against Bret Hart for the championship at In Your House, Ground Zero, just 2 months after his debut. It made sense, I guess, that in the middle of this U.S. versus Canada stuff they were doing at the time, you would have this guy who called himself The Patriot, and he had this cool-looking, colorful mask, but the character reminded me more of something you would have found in WWE 10 years earlier. You know, at a time where the Attitude Era was really kicking in, I just never thought that character really fit. Wasn't anything wrong that he did, and he looked great. And, you know, by all accounts, he was a team player, he was well-liked and all that, but I don't know, I never felt like the Patriot really fit. He kind of stuck out like a sore thumb. He got his start in the dying days of the AWA as the Trooper, and he would write out a ticket that he would give to his opponent after he had already beaten them. I don't know what this crime was that they committed or what the ticket was for. I mean, the way some of those guys moved in the ring back then, it definitely wasn't for speeding. But then he went to Global. He found success there as the Patriot. He was a tag team champion with Marcus Bagwell in WCW as Stars and Stripes. And finally, he landed in WWE in 1997, right in the middle of the US-Canada feud with the Hart Foundation. And I think back to that period, and it's like, God, you know, there's so many of those guys who were involved in that story that are just gone now. You know, Bret and Austin are two of the few that are left. I mean, you know, Shawn Michaels is still around, Undertaker is still around. But you think of everybody else who was really involved, from the Hart Foundation angle to Vader, Patriot, obviously, Legion of Doom. So many guys are just no longer with us anymore. He had Kurt Angle's theme music before Kurt did. He was rocking that theme song a couple of years, in fact, before Kurt Angle started using it. And a few weeks after he debuted, he rolled up and pinned Bret Hart on an episode of Raw after Shawn Michaels interfered in their match. They were setting him up as Bret's first title defense after Bret won the championship at SummerSlam. The Patriot would be an easy opponent for Bret to beat in his first defense, and they had that match at Ground Zero. Bret beat him with the sharpshooter, and they had a pretty good match. You know, after I heard about what happened here, I actually went back, and I hadn't seen that match maybe since I first saw it, and I watched the match, and it's actually a pretty good match. You know, the main event of that show is one of the best brawls you'll ever see between Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker. I mean, it doesn't get talked about enough because it gets overshadowed by the Hell in a Cell and the WrestleMania matches years later. But I loved their Ground Zero match. But that's a different story. After that, the Patriot disappeared. He was supposed to be part of Team USA at Survivor Series, but he tore his triceps, which he had a history of, triceps tears. And he had also blown out his right knee, which years later he had to get replaced twice. He was riddled with injuries, and he never wrestled another match for them again. They released him early the following year and he retired. That's why his run in WWE was so brief. He really was only on television for 3 months. And in that span, in those 3 months, he pinned Bret Hart and wrestled on pay-per-view for the WWE title. But he had spent the last 16 years working as a car salesman in South Carolina. He was very open about his addiction issues and about his steroid use, really all of his drug problems. He was hoping to, you know, dissuade any younger wrestlers from going down the same path that he had gone down. When he was on Steve Austin's podcast years ago, and I think he was on Austin's show twice, he admitted to taking an average of 120 painkillers per day. That doesn't include somas and Xanax and other pills that he was taking just to fall asleep at night. And in an interview with the Pro Wrestling Stories website, he talked about an elbow injury early in his career where his elbow had swelled up to the size of a softball. And he was riding, you know, one day with Kurt Hennig and with John Nord, the Berserker. And he was talking about how much pain he was in. And Hennig says to him, like, what are you on? And he was telling, Hennig, he goes, well, I'm on just aspirin and whatever I can get over the counter. He didn't know anything of prescription drugs at the time. And it was Hennig who said to him, dude, you need something stronger than that. And he handed him a handful of something and he took it and the pain went away. And that, he says, smartened him up to the fact that there was stuff out there that was a hell of a lot stronger that could get him through the matches whenever he was hurt. Because in his mind, this is what I do for a living. I have to be able to perform. I have to be able to stay on the road. I can't just take off whenever I get hurt. And if popping some pills makes the pain go away, then so be it. But then 2 pills became 100. And 100 became 200 when he was at his worst. 200 pills a day. He said he would get offended when he would ask one of the boys for some pills and they would only hand over about 5 or 6 because he was used to taking 15 to 20 at a time. He told one story, and this is just insane, which is why I want to tell it, because it's so crazy. His ex-wife is driving him to the airport. First, though, he had to have her stop at about 6 or 7 different pharmacies to pick up the various scripts that he had called in. So she's driving, he's in the passenger seat, and he is coked out of his mind. And he is yelling at his wife that you're not driving fast enough. We got to get to the next pharmacy, come on. And he decides to inject himself. While she's driving, he injects himself with testosterone. Well, the needle goes in, he hits a blood vessel. And out squirts this trail of blood that it just squirts out, hits his wife right in the face. As she's driving, she pulls over. She says, this is not how normal people live. And his reaction was just to ask her if it was that time of the month. He couldn't understand why she was in such a bad mood. But he estimates that he was arrested about 20 times from the time he left WWE and they released him in 98 up until about 2007. 20 different arrests, all just trying to support his drug habit. He stole his doctor's ID number. He was writing fake prescriptions. He got busted. He shared these stories, again, as a cautionary tale to young wrestlers in the business not to get mixed up in the same things that he did and go down that road. And it's very likely all of the abuse that he put his body through with the drugs, I'm sure it contributed to his early demise. I mean, not to say that people can't die of a heart attack at a young age. I mean, it happens all the time, sadly. Sometimes it's hereditary, but you can't live like that and do the things that he did and not expect it to have a negative impact on your health. You know, he seemed like a nice guy. By all accounts, he was well-liked within the wrestling business, although Jim Cornette once said that some of the Harts, it was either Owen or Davey Boy, didn't like him for some reason, didn't want to work with him. But he was someone who had hoped that others could learn from the mistakes that he made. And as brief as his stint was in WWE, he accomplished more in those 3 months than a lot of people do who spend years there. AEW held its final show of the pandemic era at Daly's Place on Wednesday before they head out on the road to Miami this week for their Road Rager show. MJF picked up the win over Sammy Guevara with an assist from Sean Spears and a chair shot to the head. This was MJF's first singles match since December. And it was Sammy's first since January, which is crazy to think about. And we're not talking that both guys were injured or anything. We're now in July. And these guys had not had singles matches in that long. That's pretty nuts. I mean, I knew it felt like we never really see MJF in action at all, let alone singles matches on Dynamite. I didn't know it had been that long since he had had a singles match. And MJF and Jericho are going to have a face-off this week where MJF will get to list all of the stipulations that he wants Jericho to agree to before he gives him the match that he wants. As an aside, I saw the comments, I guess the right place to mention this, I saw the comments that Jericho made last weekend on his YouTube stream about the people who criticized his bump off the cage in the Blood and Guts match back on Cinco de Mayo, I think it was. He was asked about it, so he talked about it. I know we already talked about this previously, and there was a whole big controversy coming out of the show, people who were critiquing it, and all the fucking idiots online who were conflating the different points and saying, oh my god, I can't believe that so many people wish death upon Jericho, and they wanted him to go splatter on concrete. These are the people that have concrete in their fucking heads. They basically have concrete for brains, so we've already litigated all that, but since he brought it up, he started talking about it again, and he went off on how dangerous the spot was and that if people didn't respect the bump, you're not a real fan. There it is. There it is. The you're not a real fan argument. If you didn't respect or agree with something that I did, you're not a real fan. So that was dumb enough for him to say. But he was very bothered by people in the business who were bagging on the whole spot. You know, we put our bodies on the line. They should know better than to mock it or criticize it. And he singled out two chicks, as he called them, from WWE. He didn't name who they were, but Shayna Baszler and Shotzi Blackheart were the two that he was obviously referring to. Shotzi, I don't think Shotzi actually said anything other than she had tweeted a funny gif, I think. Shayna had one of the best takes I saw at the time. She compared it to an episode of Game of Thrones and how people don't actually want to see a village burned to the ground by a dragon. But if the special effects were garbage, it would have sucked too, and everybody would have said so. Which is absolutely true. Some common sense from Shayna Baszler, who has since been programmed on television with an evil doll. But Jericho said that these chicks probably weren't trained any better, they didn't know any better, and in 6 months, they'll probably be asking us for a job anyway, and I'll remember that. I'll remember that, he said. I guess implying that he would either make sure they weren't hired, or he would make their lives difficult there in some way. I don't know what he was implying. Like a fucking man-child. All because they thought your bump looked like shit. Not because you weren't taking a risk. Yes, you're taking a risk. Everybody knows when you fall from a great height, you are taking a risk. And we respect that risk. That's not what the criticism was for. I don't know why this is still not crystal clear in people's heads. The criticism was for the way it was shot on television. But he's too dense to understand that, apparently. So this was a terrible take from Jericho, and I thought the Brian Alvarez take was bad. When he whined about the people who complained about the bump by suggesting those people just stop watching. Just stop watching Dynamite. Which is just rich for so many reasons. For so many reasons. But him saying that about Shotzi and Shayna just because they dared mock how poorly it was shot, not that he used the crash pad for the spot, which he vehemently denied. He absolutely did. I don't know why he denies that he did, but you can clearly see it with your own two fucking eyes. And there's nothing wrong with that, but I don't know why he is so sensitive about this. No one wanted him to fall on actual concrete. I hope we can put that to bed once and for all. Anyway, the Young Bucks suffered a rare loss to Eddie Kingston and Penta, which sets up a tag team title match in Miami this Wednesday. The coffin match between Darby Allin and Ethan Page has been delayed to Fyter Fest the following week. And, you know, we were talking about this on the live stream on Wednesday night on YouTube, and somebody had sent in a message pointing out the fact, or asking the question, do you think that maybe this match was delayed because of the building collapse in Miami, where they are still digging through the rubble, pulling out bodies and looking for any survivors, although at this point that there's, I mean, they're not looking for survivors at this point. But very possible. In fact, I think that probably has a lot to do with why it was delayed. Otherwise, it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. You know, if you wanted to have that match at Fyter Fest, they should have just announced it for Fyter Fest. And then all of a sudden, it's like they're stalling, unless somebody is hurt. But then this person mentioned the Miami connection. I thought, you know, having a coffin match at a time where you're pulling bodies out of the wreckage of this building that collapsed, it could very well have something to do with that. Rebel, not Reba. She was injured. She suffered a dislocated kneecap in a tag team match on Dynamite. It was her and Britt Baker against Nyla Rose and Vicky Guerrero. And apparently she's going to be okay. I would imagine she will not be in the ring for a little bit. But you can clearly tell she dove into the ring at one point to make a save, to break up a pinfall. And it didn't look like, you know, she landed in any kind of awkward way, but apparently she did, and she dislocated the kneecap. I guess they popped it back into place in the back. So that is the update on her injury. And Ricky Stark, speaking of injuries, has been medically cleared from his fractured neck ahead of schedule and will wrestle Brian Cage for the FTW title at Fyter Fest in 2 weeks. Very happy to see Ricky Stark's back. Hopefully he takes care of himself. He is one of the shining young stars in that company. They need him healthy for many years to come. WWE Network has completed its ranking of the top 50 tag teams in company history. Oh boy. When it comes to these WWE lists, this gets people all riled up. They have been airing these countdowns in various installments hosted by the recently released Tyler Breeze and Fandango. And this week, they were down to their top five. As with all of these WWE lists, you take them for what they are. There absolutely is a recency bias with some of their lists. Other lists just have no credibility whatsoever. Like the list they put up a week ago on their YouTube channel of John Cena's 10 greatest rivals. See, they're already teasing that John Cena is coming back. They're dropping John Cena content on the YouTube channel. But they had this list of his top 10 greatest rivals. Now imagine doing a list, a credible list, of John Cena's 10 greatest opponents, his 10 greatest rivals, and leaving CM Punk off of such a list. And I know why they would do it. It's still stupid. It's so dumb. You know, even if you don't believe that Punk is Cena's number one rival, if you believe WWE that Randy Orton is, to not even include Punk in the top 10, at that point, it's not even a subjective thing. It's just completely invalid. You've just completely invalidated your list. But they do this sort of thing all the time. It's not anything to get overly upset about. I mean, I joke about how dumb some of it is, but I learned a long time ago not to get too upset about it. But here, though, they were only counting teams that competed in WWE. And they were mainly focusing on their WWE accomplishments. So they had an honorable mention segment for teams like Harlem Heat and the Midnight Express, Hollywood Blondes, the Outsiders, the Pitbulls, a bunch of other teams. They said they took into account the number of title reigns each team had, the longevity of each team, and their cultural impact, whatever the hell that means. You know, being quoted in pop culture, I mean, they didn't really expound on that, but that's the criteria that they used. And by that criteria, their top five was not unreasonable. They had the Dudley Boys at number five, Edge and Christian at number four, the Hart Foundation at number three, the Hardy Boys at number two, and the number one greatest tag team in WWE history, according to WWE, is The New Day, which is a trio. They didn't say which combination of New Day members, so I guess they're including all three of them. That's a little unfair, I would say. I mean, by that account, I mean, they didn't have the longevity, but shit, where's the Shield? How come they're not on there? But they had the Legion of Doom at number 6, Usos at number 7, New Age Outlaws at number 8, Undertaker and Kane at 9, Bulldogs at 10, Demolition 11, Steiner Brothers were down at number 17. They put Undisputed Era at number 20, ahead of the Shield at number 22. So those were some of the key spots. I'm not going to go through the whole list. Now, I understand why they would put New Day in the top spot in terms of longevity. They've been together for, what, 7 years now, I think, right? 2014, I think, is when they first came together. 7 years, or almost 7 years. That's a long time. Nobody expected them to get over the way that they did. Myself included. And they proved a lot of people wrong. Is the classic story that Kofi Kingston tells of the Big Show, thinking that this thing was going to fail. And boy, was he wrong, right? So they proved a lot of people wrong even within the company. They're still a popular act. You can say that they're not as popular as they used to be. That, you know, they've kind of run their course, which, you know, isn't true. I mean, it's not like they're hearing crickets when they come out. I mean, we'll find out, I guess, right, when they're back in front of crowds in a few weeks. But they're still popular. You know, yes, they sell a lot of merch, although on my personal list, I don't really give a shit about how much merch they've sold. But I'm sure WWE cares, right? They've made a lot of money off those three guys. They have, 11 tag team titles, I believe, between Raw and SmackDown. They beat Demolition's run as the longest reigning tag champs in WWE history at 483 days. They've had plenty of very good matches. They've even had some great ones, mostly with the Usos. I mean, if we're being honest, pretty much all of the memorable New Day matches involve the Usos. They've had a lot of good matches, but the great ones are pretty much limited just to those, you know, that one team that they feuded with. They've had some other ones that stand out. I mean, they had a match against the Shield at Survivor Series a few years ago, against the Wyatt family, against Cesaro and Tyson Kidd. But it's mainly their matches against Jimmy and Jay, especially in like the summer into the fall of 2017, the SummerSlam match, the Hell in a Cell match, which I think is their best. But it's mainly for that reason I don't have them as number one on my list. For a good part of the New Day's run, the tag team division in WWE has been weak. You've got two, maybe three kind of big teams max at any given moment, with a bunch of other makeshift teams just kind of thrown together. At a time when, I mean, while we see a lot of tag team matches on television, there really was not a whole lot of emphasis put on tag team wrestling in WWE in terms of the division itself and putting together a strong division. The competition just isn't there when you compare to the tag divisions, let's say, in the 80s or the early 90s, even 1999. They had a lot of strong teams on the roster at that time, all competing for one set of tag team belts, and I'm sure that doesn't help, having two different tag team championships at a time when you can barely cobble together a division. That's one of the biggest problems right now that I have with the tag team scene in WWE. It would be a lot better off having one set of tag belts like they do for the women and everybody chasing after those one set of titles and then floating from one show to the next. But, you know, back then you had all these teams going after one set of tag team belts. And also, you know, it's just a matter of personal taste. I was not always a fan of all the New Day silliness. Some of it I thought was amusing and some of it was fun. A lot of it I just found to be obnoxious. Some people like their shtick, other people don't. I'm kind of in the middle on it. But they are not the number one greatest tag team on my list of great WWE teams, and I feel like I need to have two separate lists here depending on the criteria. So I have put together my own personal top five. And my top five may look different than your top five, but that's why it's mine and not yours. So if I'm giving you my own biased list of my top five favorite teams in WWE history, I've got Demolition in the top spot. I loved everything about the team, from the look to the entrance music, which is still one of the best WWE themes of all time. They had a cool finish. And they worked in an era with some fantastic tag teams. So I have Demolition as my number one. But it was close. I'm not going to lie, it was close. They just edged out the Hart Foundation, who I have at number two. I waffled a bit on who to put at number one, but the Harts, I have at number two. You know, Brett and Anvil, they complemented each other so well. They had the great Heart Attack finish. Not the best tag team finish, but I always thought it was cool. And they had classic matches with a bunch of different teams, from the Bulldogs to the Killer Bees, which I didn't really fully appreciate until I started watching those old, you know, primetime wrestling episodes, I think it was, and they would show those matches, and it's like, holy shit, the Killer Bees don't get enough credit for being a really good team. But they had great matches with the Bulldogs and the Killer Bees and the Rockers and the Brainbusters and Demolition. They didn't just feud with one team. So for all of those reasons, I got to put the Harts at number two. Legion of Doom at number three. Even though they didn't really do all that much during their WWE run. I saw a lot of people posting tweets and comments. Oh, holy shit. How do you not have LOD at number one? A lot of those people didn't pay attention to the fact that this is a WWE list. The way they put this together, they made that very clear. They were focusing on WWE teams and their WWE accomplishments. And I think it's fair to not put them in number one if you're going by that metric, because they really didn't do a whole lot, if you think about it, in WWE. You know, their run there, their first run was only 2 years. They won the tag team titles once, and it was a very bizarre situation when they dropped them, which didn't even air on television. They had no memorable matches that I could think of outside of when they beat the Nasty Boys for the belts at SummerSlam. And they blew the roof off MSG that night. But they did become the first and only team to ever hold the AWA, NWA, and WWE tag team titles. You know, but I readily admit they didn't really do much else there. Even in their second run, I thought it was very disappointing. And don't even get me started on the fucking, you know, LOD 2000 shit back in 98. And then the stuff they did with Hawk being drunk and all that. I mean, their second run was just, you know, disappointing. And they were older by that point. They weren't the same. But when I think of tag team wrestling, I think of the Road Warriors. I think of the face paint. I think of the spike shoulder pads, the music. Whether it was Iron Man or, you know, even their music when they came to WWE. I think of the Doomsday Device. These guys were total badasses. They were tag team wrestling. I wasn't even really watching the NWA or AWA stuff when I was a kid. I was aware of it through reading Pro Wrestling Illustrated, but I would see the advertisements in the magazine with Hawk and the face paint and the action figures. And before they even came to work for Vince, I knew of them. And I thought, hey, they look pretty cool. They were tag team wrestling. I don't think that you can have a top five without having them on that list. I have the Dudleys in number four. And I have the Steiner Brothers in number five. But again, that's my personal biased top five list of favorite tag teams. If I stick to the criteria, the exact criteria that WWE used here, then New Day is in the top five. But I would have them further down the list, maybe at number four. I think if they had come along and had the kind of success they did at a different time, in a different era, with better teams and more real teams to work with, then they would be higher. But right now, I can't put them higher than that. Now, 10 or 20 years from now, when New Day is no more, I might look back more favorably and be open to ranking them higher. But for now, with all the great tag teams that there have been, there is no way that I can put the New Day at number one on the list of the greatest tag teams of all time, even on a WWE-only list. But feel free to chime in and let me know what your list looks like. Where, if anywhere, on your list does the New Day rank? Raw Monday Night scored its third lowest viewership of all time, with just 1.57 million live viewers on Monday. They were up against an NBA playoff game that did 5.7 million viewers, so it took some of its audience away, but they've been up against the NBA before. Year over year, Raw is down almost 10% in viewers and 15% in the key demo. The lows just keep getting lower. Randy Orton was not there this week, and there was no reason given as for why he missed the show, so they had a battle royal to determine who would take his spot in the Last Chance Money in the Bank qualifier against Drew McIntyre and AJ Styles. Matt Riddle, who already qualified, convinced Adam Pearce and Sonya Deville to let him act as a surrogate for Orton in the battle royal, which came down to Riddle and Damian Priest, who finally resurfaced. He was said to be out dealing with a personal issue of some kind, so hopefully that's all fixed and finished. Maybe a Bad Bunny needed a roadie or something, who knows. I liked that it came down to the two of them because I thought Priest was taking it. I thought that it could have reasonably gone either way, but I had him picked as the winner here. But they went with Riddle, who has been all over these shows. Can we just acknowledge how much television time Matt Riddle is being given right now? Clearly, Vince McMahon is a fan of his. He has been one of the lucky ones so far as NXT call-ups are concerned. If that's how you judge, if you judge it by how much television time and, you know, what spot you're featured in on the show, you may not be a fan of the Riddle gimmick and how goofy he is. He was doing a little bit of the goofy stuff already in NXT. They just completely ratcheted up the goofiness on Raw. But he has been, I would say, one of the lucky ones as far as the NXT call-ups go, and he has been putting on some great matches, showing what I said for years about what he can do in the ring. I'm not a fan of the over-the-top goofiness, but he's a main event level talent in the ring. And he's showing it. They kept the Alexa Bliss stuff to a minimum this week, which was a plus, but Shayna Baszler lost another match, rolled up and pinned again, this time by the almost superhero, Nikki Cross. That's going to be her new name from now on, apparently, Nikki Ash. Almost the superhero. Better than a superhero in training, right? You consider what that stands for. There's a lot of that on this show. The S-H-I-T. But Nikki Ash is her new name now. I guess making way for the impending debut of Karrion Kross. Can't have more than one Cross. Karrion Kross, who was once again brought in this week, as were Bronson Reed and Scarlett and Shotzi Blackheart and even Toni Storm for either dark matches or main event matches so that people, all the executives and the writers and the people behind the scenes who apparently don't watch USA Network on Tuesday nights so that they can get a good look at these people and find out who they are, what they're about. I said last week that the Kofi Kingston MVP face-off would probably be the best thing on this show this week. And it was. That and the main event were the best things on Monday Night Raw. Kofi promised to make Bobby Lashley pay at Money in the Bank for what he did to Xavier Woods inside Hell in a Cell last week. MVP said Lashley would make what Brock Lesnar did to him seem like nothing. And Kofi said that when he was WWE champion, he defended the title every week for 6 months. He took the title all over the world. He took it to Ghana. Yes, and then he lost in 8 seconds like a loser and went right back to being a comedy clown without putting up a fuss on TV about wanting his belt back. And yes, he was a clown because he was throwing fucking pancakes out to the crowd. They had him as the WWE champion, lost the championship in embarrassing fashion, right back to tossing pancakes into the fucking crowd. Now he wants that. Now I understand that's the fault of the writing team. I'm just saying. I'm just pointing out how ridiculous it all is. But now he wants the title back. Now he's getting angry. It took 2 years. Now he's getting angry about it. If only he had been this serious about it back then. But Kofi said that Woods would be back on TV this Monday and that MVP is milking his knee injury. MVP said the injury is real and I'm not cleared or else I'd kick your ass right now. And Kofi left him laying with a trouble in paradise. So they announced a rematch for tomorrow night with Lashley again taking on Xavier Woods. But this time it would be a straight singles match. So they were going from Hell in a Cell, non-title, to just this good old singles match, non-title. But that has since changed. And now it is going to be a tag team match. It is going to be Xavier Woods and Kofi Kingston taking on Lashley and MVP. This would be MVP's first match back since he injured his knee in February. I hope that doesn't mean that he's going to ditch the cane. I think the cane, you know, the little pimp stick that he walks to the ring with, I think it works for him. Eva Marie gave Doudrop a chance to make up for her mistake the week before by dropping down off the apron during their match and letting her fend for herself 2-on-1 against Asuka and Naomi this week. And much to Eva's chagrin, much to her surprise, Doudrop had no problem doing so. She pinned Asuka clean in the middle with a running body splash. Doudrop was shooting dirty looks as Eva just, you know, nonstop on this show. I think if they build this up more once they're back in front of live crowds, I think they'll pop pretty big when the day comes that she body splashes Eva and squashes her like a grape. And when that happens, they need to change her fucking name back to Piper Niven. I am hoping that that is the idea here, that this is building to a body splash on Eva and a split, and then she goes off on her own. If that isn't the plan, it should be. John Morrison and Ricochet. They were having a match when we got to see Ricochet doing Ricochet things, which is an easy formula if they were to ever get serious about pushing this guy. He can do things that most people simply cannot do. I've called him in the past a walking video game character. I know we have a lot of that in wrestling these days, but he truly is a step above. The things that he can do, people should not physically be able to do. He's a special talent. Now, he can't cut a promo to save his life, but he can do insane things, and this was one of them. Morrison was sitting on the barricade outside the ring when Ricochet hit a springboard crossbody from the ring onto Morrison, taking him over the barricade. Now, obviously, there was a crash pad on the other side that we could not see, which Chris Jericho vehemently denies. But there was a crash pad there that we couldn't see. That is one of the benefits of being in the Thunderdome. It looked fucking amazing. And they replayed it a whole bunch of times, which I would have done the same. Both men were counted out. But all anybody was talking about when this was over was that spot. That'll be up there with Ricochet diving out of the ring and landing on his feet at Full Sail that time when he confronted the Velveteen Dream. And as Simon pointed out to me in an email, we had in this match here, we had Johnny Mundo wrestling Prince Puma. And it made me long for those days, again, of Lucha Underground. If you've never seen the all-night-long match that those two had, it's basically an Iron Man match. It literally was a one-match show. Go and find it. They have all of the episodes of Lucha Underground up for free on the Tubi TV app, T-U-B-I. I'm telling you, go check it out. Before the main event, Drew McIntyre was in the back talking to the new announcer, Kevin Patrick, when he started telling an old story about the Scottish fighting the Irish and the British and these historical promos, and this one was phony. He was making up stories here. But these promos, they are not cool. They are not funny. They are not even all that amusing. Then I see Drew McIntyre on Raw Talk, because I had heard that he gave this great promo. So I watched Raw Talk. And he really was good, just talking about chasing after the championship and all the physical abuse he's taken recently, going nonstop. That is the Drew McIntyre that we need to be seeing and hearing more of on Raw, not the Scottish history professor. So let's get a little bit less of that and more of this on Raw. And to the surprise of no one, McIntyre won his way into the Money in the Bank ladder match with a win over AJ Styles and Matt Riddle in the main event of this show. They went almost 30 minutes. Very good match. This would be how Drew works around the stipulation that he can never again challenge Lashley for the championship, which I think is a mistake. If he wins this Money in the Bank match, I think that's a mistake. He has lost so many times. I think you run a very big risk of turning the fans against him if he wins that Money in the Bank match. He would have to be the favorite right now, either him or Big E. But we still have a couple of names left to qualify. SmackDown on Friday night. We are approaching the end of these Thunderdome shows. We only have about a couple left. I enjoyed SmackDown for the most part this week, even without Roman Reigns. Apparently WWE didn't, because the ratings, the overnight ratings were not looking so good for this week's show. It was the lowest yet, I think, since the move to Fox. So Roman was not on the show this week, and I don't think he has to be on the show every week. I think it's good to keep him off now and again. But you can clearly tell they are in a holding pattern until the draft. They're feuding the same people over and over and over again, week after week after week. Owens and Zayn, Big E and Apollo, Rollins and Cesaro, Bianca and Bayley, every single week for months, for months. It's one thing to have one story like this, long-term. You got four of them. Baron Corbin. Here's a story I can actually appreciate. Baron Corbin has hit rock bottom. Not only has he lost his crown, but he made some bad investments. He has lost thousands of dollars. It's a good thing JBL isn't around anymore, or else he might end up working for him the way that Shawn Michaels did when he, remember, he made bad investments, probably in that hair growth product that clearly didn't work out. Corbin was walking around all mopey and all sad, and during the Corbin and Cruz against Big E and Nakamura match, he was distracted mid-match by footage up on the Tron of his car being towed from the parking lot. Or as we would find out, it's not his car, but his car was being towed and he was distracted and he got pinned. After the show, and you may not have seen this, but after the show, they posted a video showing Corbin, and maybe this may be on their YouTube channel as well, showing Corbin walking up to Dolph Ziggler in the back, who was in the middle of, I don't know, talking about the 4th of July or something. And Corbin walks up to him and he wants to sell him his watch. He said the car that got repoed was his wife's. And if he doesn't get it back, she's going to kill him. And she doesn't know about his debts and all the money he lost and everything. He said the watch was worth $40,000. He was willing to sell it, though, to Dolph for $35,000. And Ziggler said, $10,000 and you got a deal. And he ended up paying cash for it. Ziggler reached in his pocket, he pulled out a wad of cash, and he took the watch. I can't believe that I'm saying this, but they're actually getting me to care about Baron Corbin and feel sympathy for this guy. I like this. We're finally getting something different with Baron Corbin after 2 years of this king nonsense. They've trademarked the name Happy Corbin. So we'll see where that goes, but it's different. For a guy who desperately needed to start doing something different, it is different, and I can appreciate that. Bianca Belair challenged Bayley to an I Quit match for the Women's Championship at Money in the Bank, which Bayley accepted, but she took it one step further, Bayley did, and she joked that she would probably quit SmackDown or WWE altogether if Bianca made her quit. Now, they didn't make that an official stipulation yet, that if Bayley loses, she's off SmackDown, but we'll see if they follow up on that, because I still think Becky Lynch is coming back to SmackDown on that July 16th show and going to have a match with Bayley at SummerSlam. I mean, we all know Becky is coming back, but I think it'll be that night, and I think it's going to set up her and Bayley at SummerSlam. If they move Bayley to Raw, I'm going to be very upset not getting to hear her, berate Michael Cole every week. It's been one of the great joys of the pandemic era. She even did an interview this week, Bayley did, saying that she's going to make a match happen at some point with her and Michael Cole. I think we could all be spared the sight of Michael Cole in that horrific gear again that he wore for his match at WrestleMania with Lawler. I don't think we need to see that again. But we'll see if they follow up on that, on that dialogue, on that verbiage there from Bayley, talking about how she'll leave SmackDown if she loses. We had a deliciously brutal last man standing match between Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn for a spot in the Money in the Bank ladder match. These two beat the holy hell out of each other. Owens stacked two tables up outside the ring in the corner, just like he did, someone did, in the last man standing match that he and Dean Ambrose had at the Royal Rumble back in 2016. And he tried to superplex Zayn from inside the ring out onto the tables, but Sami countered out of it, and then later on it was Sami pushing Owens off the top rope, down through both tables. And Owens barely beat the count back into the ring. Sami hit the Huluva kick, but Owens beat the count. He hit a second kick, held Owens up, though, and yelled that this is karma before hitting him with a third kick. But Owens had the presence of mind to roll out under the bottom rope at 9, and he landed upright on his feet, which broke the count. Owens came back, hit a pop-up powerbomb and a stunner. Zayn rolled out to the floor. Owens followed him out and told Sammy, "No, no, no, this is karma." And he powerbombed him through the announce desk, picked him right back up, powerbombed him through another table that was nearby, picked him back up, and I love this. In a nice callback to Owens' very first night on NXT when he turned on Sammy, he turned on his best friend. Remember, and he gave him the apron powerbomb. This is right after Sammy had just won the NXT championship from Neville. Here, he powerbombed Zayn on the ring apron, and that is the move that he used to put away Sami Zayn and earn himself a spot in the Money in the Bank match. An excellent match here with some great storytelling. Sami Zayn is underappreciated for what he brings to this show. I see people who talk on social media, "Oh, I don't see what the big deal. He looks like Fidel Castro. He looks, you know, he doesn't look like a wrestler." He may not look like a wrestler, but he's a fucking wrestler. Once he gets in the ring and the bell goes off and he's in there doing his thing, he's one of the best they have in that entire company. You know what's scary is that as great as he is as a heel, and I love Sammy as a heel, there were a lot of people, and I might have been one of them at the time, but there were a lot of people at the time who criticized WWE when he turned heel. How can you turn one of the best baby faces that you've got heel? And then, of course, he went out and he killed it as a heel. So when you're able to go out there and be a great baby face or a great heel, that's not an easy thing to do. Usually it's one or the other. He excels at both. So for all the people who may criticize Sammy for his appearance or the way he dresses in the ring, his gear or whatever, you know, it's part of the gimmick that he's doing right now. This will change over time. This will evolve. He'll probably go back to being a babyface at some point. But I still think he is underappreciated for what he can do and what he can contribute in the ring when the bell rings. Sonya Deville was out to introduce the next participant in the Women's Money in the Bank ladder match because this brand is so devoid of talent in the division, they have to handpick the entrance instead of holding qualifying matches like Raw does for the men and the women, and like SmackDown does for the men. This was the return of Zelina Vega, who no longer supports unionization, apparently, as she deleted her tweet that said as much from November. She came crawling right back after all. All the rumors about will she, won't she, oh, she was spotted at the Performance Center. But no, 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 she hasn't signed anything. She might go to AEW. She might go somewhere else. She came right back to WWE. Well, look, they all do. Let's be honest, they all do. At some point, they all come crawling back. Her husband does not plan to do the same. He does not plan to join her. If he is to be believed, on his Twitch stream the other day, he said he has no plans to return to WWE right now. He said he is in a much better place. And one thing that might back him up on this, that he isn't coming in, is that he just signed a sponsorship deal with an MMA clothing brand. I can't see WWE allowing that if he was coming back. So I actually don't think that Aleister Black is coming back, at least not right away. But Zelina Vega is back. And on her first night, she lost to Liv Morgan, who was very upset about being passed over yet again for a spot in the Money in the Bank. They have this little story going where Sonya keeps passing over Liv Morgan. So these two had a match, and Zelina got rolled up and pinned. If we assume that there are going to be 8 names in each Money in the Bank match, we now have 6 announced for the women's match. It is pretty clear that Liv Morgan is going to end up being one of those names involved. But I think this is all building to Sonya Deville entering herself into Money in the Bank. She'll save herself as the last entrant announced for the match. I am loving this new attitude from Otis. He destroyed Angelo Dawkins this week. I was thinking, you know, that we would get the Usos winning the tag team title soon off of Rey and Dominic. But I've had a change of heart. I would like to see the Alpha Academy destroy those two and get a run with the belts. The Usos don't need them right now. These two right here, look, they could be grooming Otis for a big singles push. I don't see him going up against Roman Reigns. And the Intercontinental title is on a heel right now. Maybe they're really building Otis up and he's going to move in the draft and go to Raw. I mean, I wouldn't split him and Gable up. I think that's a mistake. I love this whole partnership and this team, this union between them. And you know, in storyline, what he has done to Otis. Turned him into this serious monster who just goes in there and destroys people. They're the ones I'd like to see beat the Mysterios for the belts. Speaking of the Usos, the main storyline on this show is Jimmy Uso calling out Edge with the idea that I've got Roman's back and I know Roman's got mine. So you had to know that when Jimmy ended up getting his ass kicked at the end of the night, there would be no Roman Reigns. Paul Heyman was there, but we never saw Roman Reigns. And that's exactly how it played out. Paul Heyman sent Jimmy out there at the end to call out Edge. Edge came out. At first, Edge was thinking, okay, this is a trap. You guys have set a trap for me. But then he kind of changed his mind and he told Jimmy, he goes, it's not a trap for me. It's a trap set for you. Because Jimmy thought Roman was going to come out and back him up. He looked around. There's no Roman Reigns. So these two brawled. Edge got the upper hand, had Jimmy in the crossface with a metal piece that he broke off of a folding chair. He had that bar in Jimmy's mouth as he pulled back on the crossface. There was no Roman Reigns to save Jimmy Uso. No Jey Uso. We haven't seen him in a few weeks. Roman Reigns left his cousin out there to die. And look, they have to be able to get by some weeks without Roman. I thought they did a good job this week. I thought Owens and Zayn killed it in their match. Otis was one of the real standouts of the night. Call me crazy. I'm even kind of starting to dig what they're doing with Corbin. Curious to see where they... And I think that's more just born out of me being so fucking sick of him in this stupid King gimmick for so long that overstayed its welcome, that I'm just happy to see them doing something different with the guy. So I'm even digging that right now. And then Zelina Vega back. I know that that is going to upset... I already see a lot of people online. And let me just address that. Because you have people online who are tweeting at her. They're tagging Zelina Vega and they're tweeting at her all kinds of abuse. You're a terrible person. What a hypocrite. You're a sellout. You know, you should be ashamed and all of this different stuff. Look, if you have that opinion, there's no need to harass the fucking woman and tag her in every stupid message, every fucking piece of diarrhea that comes out of your mind. The reality of it is this: she made a business decision. At the end of the day, it is about business. No matter what people say, oh, passion, this and that, it's about fucking business. It's about dollars and cents. Don't let them say otherwise. Dollars and cents. And it takes more than one person to stand up to an entire company if they truly believe in what they're saying. Right? Andrew Yang and all the people who chimed in at the time about the unionization stuff, which was never going to happen. They were never seriously going to do anything. It was all lip service. We all knew it was. And she realized that. And she probably just missed her job and her friends and the paycheck. And the first chance she got, they went back. Now, I see reports that WWE or someone from the company apologized to her. I don't know if they did or not. They obviously said what they had to say to try to get her back. They wanted her back. And they got her back. She is not the first to go crawling back. And she damn sure will not be the last. But there's no need to personally harass the woman over it. If you want to believe that she was a hypocrite for saying the things she said and then going back, you know what? That's a valid criticism. But don't be a dipshit. A scary injury to Mercedes Martinez and a surprise title change mark this week's episode of NXT, which has me worried for Bronson Reed. They are resurrecting the breakout tournament that they last did 2 years ago, which was a showcase for names like Bronson Reed and Swerve Scott, Cameron Grimes, Dexter Lumis, Angel Garza, Joaquin Wilde, Boa, and Jordan Miles, who won the entire thing and was conveniently left out of the video package this week. Things did not turn out well for the winner that year, so I can understand why they would not want to feature him in that video, but they're hoping to have better luck with it this year. The tournament begins on the July 13th episode of NXT, 1 week after the Great American Bash, which is this Tuesday. There will again be 8 participants in this tournament, although we don't know who all of those 8 will be, with the winner receiving a future title shot of their choosing. Some qualifying matches have already taken place, with Andre Chase, the former Harlem Bravado, beating Guru Raj, and Joe Gacy beating Desmond Troy, 2 former Evolve stars, moving on. Carmelo Hayes tweeted this week that he wants in, based on what we have seen of him so far on NXT television. I think he could be the breakout star of the entire tournament. I would think that they would include someone from Hit Row, or someone from Diamond Mine. Tyler Rust, maybe. We'll see. But getting new faces on TV is not a bad thing. Io Shirai and Zoe Stark won a triple threat number one contenders match over Ember Moon and Shotzi Blackheart and Dakota Kai and Raquel Gonzalez to earn the right to challenge Candice and Indy for the women's tag team titles of the Great American Bash this Tuesday. Great action here, with Gonzalez taking a bullet for Dakota at one point when Io hit her moonsault off the top. And yet still, in the end, it was Dakota taking the pinfall loss to another moonsault. It's looking more and more likely to me that Raquel is going to be the one to turn against Dakota after seeing her as the weak link in their alliance and their team. And Dakota Kai challenges for the championship as a babyface. I think that's the way I would go with it. Johnny Gargano jumped Karrion Kross as soon as he entered the building, and Kross stormed to the ring and dared Gargano to come out and face him, which he did, but not before Austin Theory jumped him from behind. Gargano and Theory got into a waiting car after that and sped away, or so we thought. Later in the show, as Kross and Scarlett were leaving, he was again jumped by Gargano and Theory, and this time, though, he got the upper hand, and he choked out Johnny in the parking lot. He beat up Austin Theory. So then he looks down, and he's talking to Scarlett. He looks down, he sees Gargano on the ground, and he looks at the car. And he looks at Johnny, and he looks at the car. And they quickly get into the car. He backs up like he's about to run this guy over. And then he speeds away. But after he speeds away, we see that Samoa Joe had lifted Gargano up off the ground like a child and basically saved this fucker's life. I don't know who we are supposed to be rooting for here. You know, Johnny Gargano is supposed to be the babyface in this, but he's not. I don't know what's going on here. You know, we have 2 heels, 1 chicken shit, battling it out. I don't know where this is going. It feels like they just really don't have any other credible babyfaces right now to feud with Karrion Kross, and this is the best that they could come up with. Joe is still not medically cleared, even though that would be the obvious match to build to. 1 week after returning as part of the new Diamond Mine faction, and days after his wife was fired by the company, Roderick Strong picked up a win over Asher Hale. This was a very dull follow-up to last week's debut. No promo or explanation outside of Malcolm Bivens saying Diamond Mine is open for business, and this is just the beginning. Cameron Grimes picked up a squash win and is pretty much a babyface now. LA Knight interrupted Grimes' celebration after and said, "Nobody cares." Grimes challenged him to a match at the Great American Bash for the $1 million title, which Knight initially declined, but then he thought about it and he had a change of heart. Provided that Grimes agrees to his terms, which is that he'll put the title on the line, but if Grimes loses, he has to become Knight's butler. Then he will agree to the match. So they're doing the Jerry and George storyline from Seinfeld for the pilot that they pitched to NBC. Only without the, they didn't have the $1 million belt on Seinfeld. There's no way that Cameron Grimes wins that championship next week. We are about to get Cameron Grimes butler vignettes on NXT television. And if he is not a full-fledged babyface yet, which I think he is pretty much, he will be after the Butler stuff runs its course. The fans like this guy. It's like the Corbin stuff on SmackDown. They're going for sympathy. And I think the Corbin stuff may end up getting over, but Grimes is much more likable, I think, naturally, to the fans than Baron Corbin is. The fans like this guy. They want to root for him. So they're going to drag him through the mud and ultimately build him back up. And eventually he will get the win. Eventually he will get the big win, maybe in front of a big crowd and get this big babyface ovation. And it'll be great. So I am enjoying this. We had a face-to-face promo in the ring with Adam Cole and Kyle O'Reilly ahead of their match at the Great American Bash. They were joined by Sheriff Samoa Joe, who said that he was there to keep the peace. Cole said that Kyle is nothing without him. He carried him on his back for years. Cole is still the star. And he was speaking, Cole was, with such conviction and passion in his voice that the crowd started to get behind him, even though he is the asshole in this whole scenario. Everyone knows he's the best, from these people to Samoa Joe, and even Kyle's own wife knows it. And that set off O'Reilly, who made it clear that he did not want Cole talking about his wife. I hope she doesn't work for WWE, or Nick Khan might fire her too. O'Reilly ended up applying a heel hook to Cole, who screamed in agony, begged Samoa Joe to get Kyle off of him, but Joe just casually walked off, and he left the ring, and hey, he wasn't provoked. Joe was not physically provoked. So he had no interest in getting involved. Eventually, he did send security into the ring, though, to separate the two. Xia Li and Boa beat Mercedes Martinez and Jake Atlas via ref stoppage after Xia connected a little too well on a nasty roundhouse kick. Martinez fell forward, straight down on her head like an MMA knockout. She legitimately got her bell rung. Her mouth was bloody. Xia went to pin her and Martinez's body went stiff. Her shoulders were up off the mat. Maybe she was supposed to kick out and she remembered and she just... But her body, you could just tell. Something was wrong. And at that point, the referee backed Xia Li away, called for the bell. They never put the camera on Mercedes again after that. But they did show a couple of replays and it just looked like a brutal shot. You really need to be on target when you throw a kick like that because you're flying blind. You're basically just hoping it lands close enough to get the intended effect, but not so close that you do what she did here and knock the other person out. Fightful said she was checked out backstage and was being taken to the hospital to be evaluated. WWE has been silent about what, if any, injuries she may have sustained. Tommaso Ciampa, Timothy Thatcher, and MSK sat across from each other in the ring. They all brought chairs into the ring and had a nice little sit-down summit. One last promo to sell their NXT Tag Team Championship match at the Great American Bash. I thought they did a good job, but the crowd was clearly more behind Ciampa and Thatcher than they were MSK. I would switch the titles on Tuesday. I thought Ciampa and Thatcher should have gotten the titles earlier in the year when they had that tournament. MSK was too new at the time. I know people were into them and everything, but they were too new. They should have been feuding this entire time with MSK, having to scratch and claw before finally getting the big win. I think Ciampa and Thatcher should win this week and make MSK chase to get the belts back. Earlier in the show, Bronson Reed was backstage being interviewed when he was interrupted by Hit Row. Isaiah Swerve Scott challenged Reed to a North American title match later in the night, and Reed accepted, which led to the main event and a new champion crowned. Talk about out of nowhere. Reed went for his tsunami splash. Ashanti the Adonis knocked him off the ropes while Top Dollar distracted the referee. Top Dollar then went charging towards Reed, who sidestepped him, and Top Dollar took this hellacious bump over the barricade through the plexiglass onto the ground. That was a great bump. Reed then tossed Adonis over the barricade as well. And as he climbed back into the ring, Scott caught him with a kick to the head and then a 450 splash to win the North American title. I am a big fan of Hit Row. If Hit Row had stock, I would be buying up tons of shares. So I don't mind them putting the title on Swerve. But after 42 days, which is not a long time, They took the championship off of Bronson Reed in an unannounced match on television. It was so sudden. They had been teasing a program with him and Santos Escobar for the title, which I guess dropped now, unless they're going to feud it without any title at stake. That, coupled with the fact that he is now being brought to television 2 straight weeks to work matches on Main Event, I think we can see the writing on the wall here. Bronson Reed is on his way to Raw or SmackDown in the draft next month. And in an interview, Reed even said on the main roster, the one guy that he wants is the tribal chief. Give me Roman Reigns first. I want to go straight to the head of the table, he says. Yeah, and then when he loses, what happens next? That's what these guys don't think about. They don't think these things through. If I were him, I would rethink that. Because when he debuts and wrestles Roman Reigns and loses, it's only downhill from there. But Vince McMahon paid a visit to the Performance Center on Thursday. He was not alone. Nick Khan was there, Bruce Pritchard, John Laurinaitis. They were all, a lot of chapstick to go around. They were all there with him, scouting talent and watching them train. It's going to be a very interesting next few months to see not only who gets called up, but what they look like. Is it physically bigger guys like a Bronson Reed and a Karrion Kross? Or is it a mix of big and small talent? You know, again, they had more matches held before SmackDown this week. Karrion Kross was there, this time in a match against Cesaro. Shotzi Blackheart took on Toni Storm. Odyssey Jones. Talk about big guys. This is why I bring up the whole thing about what are these people going to look like. Odyssey Jones was there for a match. He took on Bobby Roode. Jones is Omari Palmer. He's a 300-pound-plus former offensive guard from Syracuse University who did an 800-pound deadlift 2 years ago at the Performance Center Combine, which beat Otis's old NXT record of 775 pounds. I could only imagine Vince McMahon's reaction walking around the Performance Center, seeing somebody like him and seeing some of the bigger guys there. And we have a couple of them on the main roster already, right? We've got AJ Styles with Omos, and we've got Commander Aziz with Apollo Crews. We know he likes the big guys. I think you want to have a mix of both, but I'm very curious to see how many people, number one, are brought up, male and female, but also what they look like. And again, that draft is coming up after SummerSlam at the end of August, so we're not going to have to wait very long to find out. A guy like a Bronson Reed, if he dropped the championship because he is going to get called up, part of me is glad and happy for him, and I'm sure he's, well, I would think he's excited. Maybe he's not. But I mean, I want to see him succeed because he's a very talented big guy. You know, that tsunami splash looks like he's crushing every fucking bone in your body. It's a devastating looking finisher. He has talent. I want badly to see him do good things. I have no faith. We saw what happened with Keith Lee. We still don't know what the deal is with Keith Lee. It could be something out of WWE's control. Keith Lee is just one example. The track record makes me very nervous. And that's why at the beginning of the review, I said what happened on this show could be a sign of some bad things to come in the future for Bronson Reed. I could also see him as somebody who gets called up, gets a big push right out of the gate, and then ends up settling somewhere in the middle of the card or ends up in the middle somewhere doing some kind of comedy stuff. That's not what I want to see him doing. It's just something that people are going to be thinking as they think back to the track record of some of the other NXT call-ups. And you hope for the best, but you kind of just wait around for them to find a way to fuck it all up, as they've done so many times before. We'll see what happens. The draft is not that far away. These rosters on Mondays and Fridays desperately need to be shaken up a little bit. They need more women, especially on SmackDown. They're dying. They're dying on the vine there with that division. So they need new faces. What they do with those faces, that's what worries me.
History has been made here!
This week, in wrestling history, another jam-packed week, I'm going to start out here 35 years ago this week on June 29th, 1986. The AWA ran a show in Denver, Colorado, where Nick Bockwinkle defeated Stan Hansen via forfeit to regain the AWA World Championship for the fourth time. Hansen was a big draw in Japan working with Giant Baba, but he was still working dates in the U.S. and was surprised when Vern Gagne wanted to put the belt on him. And he did. He beat Rick Martel for the title in December of 85. He told The Wrestler magazine in a 2009 interview, "I never went to the AWA thinking I'd ever be the champion. It wasn't my idea. But everybody was complaining that Martel wasn't drawing as champion. He couldn't speak English, and there were a thousand reasons. He was a great white meat babyface. He was a good-looking guy who could sell and never die. I suspected that they were just using me to pass the belt from one babyface to another. That would have been fine if they would have just laid that out to me from the beginning. I would have been fine having it for 4 months and passing it on. But when I saw that I really wasn't being promoted, that was a problem." So he knew he could draw money for them if they would have just given him people to work with instead of putting him in mostly squash jobs on TV. So when he got to the building in Denver that night and he was told by the local promoter, Gene Reed, that he would be dropping the belt to Bockwinkle, he had some choice words for Mr. Reed before storming out of the building and going back to All Japan and taking the belt with him, which he had been advertised to defend on that tour. Per his agreement with Baba, he was going to be on that tour as the defending AWA champion, and he didn't intend to go back on his word. So he defended the title on that tour like nothing had ever happened. Back in the States, he was stripped of the championship, which was awarded to Bockwinkle, who I think had to use a different belt, maybe a tag team belt temporarily, until they could have a new AWA title made. When Gagne threatened to sue Hansen to get the belt back, as legend has it, Hansen ran the belt over with his truck and then mailed the broken pieces of the belt back to Vern right down to the mud tracks all over it. Bockwinkle actually had possession of the mangled belt for years. He would bring it with him to autograph signings until he sold it to a private Japanese collector a few years before he died. I hope it wasn't Sonny Ono or else AJ from the WWE Treasure Show on A&E is going to be very upset. 34 years ago this week, on July 4th, 1987, Jim Crockett Promotions presented its third annual Great American Bash tour, the first stop of which was on this date from the Omni in Atlanta. And this one was special because it was the debut of the War Games match, the Match Beyond, which was the brainchild of Dusty Rhodes, who came up with the idea after watching Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. He was getting beat up all the time by the Four Horsemen, and he sees this cage with a top on it in the movie. And from there, he just sort of sketched out what he wanted. He brought it to Klondike Bill, who was an ex-wrestler who was setting up rings at that point for the NWA. He didn't even want to wait until the morning to pitch the idea. They got down on the ground in the parking lot in the dark of night with a flashlight. He showed him how he wanted the whole setup in the cage to look. It was also Dusty's idea to suspend the cage from the ceiling and ominously lower it instead of the way the cage matches typically were done, which was to construct them live during the shows so the people would have to sit there and wait for them to finish. It was two rings surrounded by one giant cage with a top on it. In that first match, Dusty was on the winning side with Nikita Koloff, Paul Ellering, and the Road Warriors beating Ric Flair, Lex Luger, Arn Anderson, Tully Blanchard, and J.J. Dillon, who sustained the worst injury of his career in that match when he took, I was going to say sort of a doomsday device. It really wasn't. Animal just sort of picked him up, almost like on his side, for like a back suplex, and Hawk came off the ropes, and when he did, and it was tough too because the cage roof was very low, as Brian Pillman found out a few years later in the War Games match when he got powerbombed by Sid and almost killed. So he already had this low roof, and Dillon couldn't rotate his body properly, so when Hawk came off with a clothesline, he landed very hard on his right shoulder. And in any event, they held three more War Games matches at house shows later that year, 11 of them the following year. It wasn't until WrestleWar 92, which I would argue is the greatest War Games match of all time, that it became a once-a-year attraction. 33 years ago this week, on July 4th, 1988, at the age of 34, Adrian Adonis was one of three wrestlers killed on their way to a local show in Canada when the driver either swerved to avoid hitting a moose or actually hit the moose, depending on which version of the story you believe, sending their minivan plunging off a bridge into a creek, killing all of the passengers. Only the driver survived, albeit with severe injuries to his legs. Adonis died in the hospital a few hours later from head injuries. He was an AWA Tag Team Champion with Jesse Ventura, a WWE Tag Team Champion with Dick Murdoch, and then later on, in his later WWE run, he gained all that weight. He did the adorable Adrian Adonis gimmick, his biggest match coming at WrestleMania at the Silverdome against Roddy Piper, in what was billed as Piper's retirement match, which is funny to look back on now, but from wrestling in front of 93,000 fans, for one of the biggest promotions in the world, to traveling the Canadian wrestling circuit, I guess Adonis was doing what he had to do to make a living. But in doing so, he left behind a wife and two young daughters. 31 years ago this week, on July 4th, 1990, Brutus the Barber Beefcake suffered a gruesome injury that almost killed him. He was down in Florida. He was boating and parasailing with Brian Blair, a few other people, when a woman, who I assume was not in their party, she was in a harness. She was being pulled in by another boat, and she struck Brutus right in the face with her knees, full force at 35 miles an hour, shattering every bone in his head. People had to literally put their hands in his mouth to pry his mouth open so that he could breathe. It's almost like his entire face just sort of collapsed. It was sort of sagging. His nose was gone. His nasal cavity was completely crushed. He went totally blind in both eyes because the optic nerve had been damaged. That took 7 hours of surgery alone just to restore his vision. They had to sew his eyelids shut. They put him in a medically induced coma. I mean, this guy was a mess. 8 titanium plates in his face, 32 screws, and over 100 feet of steel wire to reconstruct his face. Brian Blair told Alex Marvez of the Miami Herald, yes, that is Alex Marvez of AEW fame. He told Alex Marvez at the time, as he turned around, he took a knee to the face. She was traveling so fast that had she hit a quarter inch lower on the nose, he would have died. The doctor said it was a blow that would have killed most people. And it's true. I mean, apparently he had so much scar tissue in his face that actually helped him. And so if he were not a wrestler, if he were not an athlete, it probably would have ended very differently for him. In his book, Beefcake told the story, and again, it is a Beefcake story in Beefcake's book. Beefcake, as a lot of wrestlers back then, is certainly prone to exaggeration. Nobody is doubting how serious these injuries were. But this story is wild. In his book, he tells a story about Hulk Hogan visiting him in the hospital and wanting to get him up and moving around. So he took him for a walk down the hallway. And as they're walking down the hallway, Beefcake's eyeball fell out of his head. And he claims it was dangling next to his cheek, which was one of the reasons why they originally had sewn his eyelid shut, to prevent something like that from happening. Thankfully for him, he had his Screen Actors Guild card and the insurance that comes with it, which took care of most, if not all, of his medical bills. He claims he got his SAG card for working on No Holds Barred, but he wasn't even in the movie, so I don't really understand that. Maybe he did stunt work on the film or something. Beefcake was getting ready at the time to challenge Mr. Perfect for the Intercontinental title at SummerSlam when all of this happened, and very likely would have won the championship, but he ended up being replaced by the debuting Texas Tornado, Kerry Von Erich. And Beefcake did not step back into the ring to wrestle again for another 3 years. And it is a miracle that he came back at all. given how devastating his injuries were. 30 years ago this week, on July 1st, 1991, WCW champion Ric Flair was fired by Jim Herd and stripped of the World Heavyweight title after the two were unable to come to terms on a new contract. Alex Marvez, there's that name again. He wrote in a story 2 days later in the Miami Herald, Flair said he was stripped of his coveted gold because he refused a new contract that would have cut his pay by more than half. Flair said the group asked him to take a drastic cut from his $780,000 annual salary by immediately signing a 2-year contract. Flair, age 40, would not comment on what he was offered, but a source said it was about $350,000 a year. That's a figure that the jet-flying, limousine-riding son of a gun found most inappropriate. I don't know how they could possibly expect me to accept their offer, Flair said yesterday from his home in Charlotte. Imagine a baseball player walking up to Jose Canseco and saying, Jose, tomorrow we're going to cut your check in half. Would they expect him to say, oh, fine. Flair and his attorney, Dennis Guthrie, were notified Monday that WCW would terminate his contract August 1st using a provision that allows the company to end the contract with 30 days' notice. The group already has stopped booking him. WCW announced Flair's firing during a television taping Monday in Macon, Georgia that will air at 6.05 p.m. Saturday on TBS. Flair said he doesn't know where he's headed, but one possibility is the rival World Wrestling Federation. After all, he is a free agent. Flair and Jim Herd did not like each other. Flair still does not like Jim Herd to this day. That was pretty clear from the Most Wanted Treasure show on A&E that they did with Flair in the season finale a few weeks ago. After Jim Crockett Promotions was sold to Turner Broadcasting, Herd was named the executive vice president of WCW. Before that, he was a station manager for a television station in St. Louis. And then he was, and this is what he kind of gets mocked for, but he was a regional manager after that for a Pizza Hut. So from Pizza Hut to WCW is quite the jump. Although by that point, Pizza Hut was probably more profitable than WCW was. By 1990, Herd didn't really see the value in Flair as a top attraction anymore. You know, there's the story of him wanting Flair to cut his hair, which Flair reluctantly did. One of his great regrets is that he cut his hair. He wanted to repackage him supposedly as Spartacus, which Flair thankfully did not do. Herd, you know, for his part, he denies that in an interview that he did last year with Conrad Thompson. And yes, I was as surprised as probably some of you are to know that Jim Herd is still alive and kicking. Well, maybe not kicking, but he's alive. But he claims that they never seriously considered doing the Spartacus Gladiator deal with Flair, but it may have been an idea that came up casually in one of their brainstorming sessions that got back to Flair. But he says they never seriously considered it. Flair offered to drop the title to Barry Windham. He felt Barry deserved it. He was a big fan of Windham's. He thought, even if it's just a token run for a few weeks, you know, I don't mind, you know, dropping it to Barry. Windham would then drop it to Lex Luger at the Great American Bash. So that was the plan. According to Flair, Herd asked Flair to let him think on it. He called Flair back later on and said, forget it. I'm sending Doug Dillinger over to your house to collect the belt. Doug Dillinger was their head of security for many years. Flair told Herd, well, then you better send a check with him for $25,000 plus interest, because that's how much of a deposit I put down on the belt, which I've never gotten back. At which point Herd said, fuck you. And Flair said, it ain't fuck me, it's fuck you. And hung up. Now this is where it can get confusing. Especially if you were not a fan back then. Flair wasn't just the WCW champion. He was the NWA champion. WCW was a member of the NWA. And for years, all NWA champions were required to put down a deposit of $25,000, which is a lot of money. I mean, $25,000 is a lot of money now, let alone back then. And the idea being that it would prevent them from taking the title somewhere else, let's say to a promotion that was outside of the NWA. Let's say going, you know, for example, to WWE, right? That was the idea. In turn, that person would get back their deposit plus any interest that would accrue over the duration of their title reign, and they would get paid that amount upon losing the title. Well, Flair won and lost the belt so many frickin' times, and he probably knew he was always going to get it back. You know, he would win it, he would lose it, he would win it, he would lose it, that he never collected on that deposit. Until now. And with interest, the amount owed came out to nearly $40,000. Heard basically told him to fuck off, in so many words. And in Flair's mind, that meant the belt was still legally his, which is what led to him taking it to WWE. Now, the NWA board of directors continued to recognize Flair as the NWA champion until he signed with WWE. Once he signed with Vince, then the title was declared vacant for the first time in the NWA's history. And it would stay that way for almost a year, until Masahiro Chono beat Rick Rude in the G1 Climax Final to become the new champion in 92. But anyway, Flair called Vince McMahon and said, "Hey, I'm ready to come. And guess what? I've got the belt." And Vince said, "Great, mail it over." And the rest is history, and that's how we got, you know, Bobby Heenan on television for weeks, teasing Flair was coming in, holding up the big gold belt. You know, if Jim Herd wasn't such an asshole, we never would have gotten the greatest Royal Rumble of all time. So I have to give a hearty thank you to Jim Herd. 28 years ago this week, on July 4th, 1993, WWE held a Stars and Stripes Challenge aboard the USS Intrepid, which is an aircraft carrier built during World War II for the United States Navy, which now sits along the Hudson River in New York City. It was designated a National Historic Landmark in 1986, and on this day, it played host to a wrestling ring. And in that ring, various athletes and celebrities were invited to get one chance to step into the ring and try to body slam what they claimed at that time was the 568-pound WWE champion Yokozuna. The list was long, with Bill Frelick of the Detroit Lions coming close to getting the big man up off his feet. Joe Morris and Pete Taglianetti of the Pittsburgh Penguins tried. Scott Burrell, who just days earlier had been drafted by the Charlotte Hornets, was the smartest one of the bunch. He took one look at Yoko once he got in the ring and said, "The hell with this," and he walked right out. Bob Backlund, Crush, who came closest. Scott Steiner, Tatanka, Randy Savage, they all tried and they all failed. Just when it looked as if the evil foreign menace from San Francisco had prevailed, Lex Luger, who up to this point had been portrayed as a self-centered heel, calling himself the narcissist, he arrived by way of helicopter, wearing an American flag shirt, to stand up for Old Glory. He shoved Bobby Heenan aside when Heenan tried to talk to him. He got into the ring, he cut this patriotic promo on Mr. Fuji and tossed him out of the ring. Yokozuna charged at him, but Luger sidestepped him and Yoko hit the turnbuckle. Luger then hit him with his loaded forearm with that big metal plate from the motorcycle accident in his forearm. And then he picked him up and he slammed him. Not the prettiest slam that I've ever seen, but a slam is a slam. That was almost all Yoko, by the way. He jumped into that. Everyone celebrated, and just like that, Vince McMahon's attempt to create the next Hulk Hogan was, in his mind, complete. You know, the infamous Lex Express came next, where they put Luger on a bus. He went on a bus tour around the country all the way through the end of August, all the way up until SummerSlam, where he failed to win the championship, but celebrated as if he had. Looked like a fool. Between the chopper entrance on the Intrepid and the bus tour, Vince McMahon tried his damnedest. I gotta give him credit. He tried his damnedest to get Luger over as the next big babyface. But Luger didn't have the real missing ingredient. If he was looking for a new Hulk Hogan, Luger did not have Hogan's charisma. He had a better physique. He had more hair on his head. But he lacked the charisma that Hogan had. And that SummerSlam finish, that was the nail in the coffin. He was still a fine babyface. I mean, it's not like people were booing him out of the building, but you could tell they were not overly enthusiastic for him. And it's been said that Vince McMahon simply decided that he wanted Luger to get the big title win at WrestleMania. He wanted to delay it until WrestleMania. But it wasn't going to matter. Even if he had delayed it and gave him the championship at WrestleMania in Madison Square Garden, it would not have mattered. It was never going to work. Luger was not Hulk Hogan. Luger was not even Bret Hart, which is who the fans wanted to see. That's why he ended up with the championship at WrestleMania and not Luger, because the people made it very clear who they wanted in that spot. 27 years ago this week, on July 3rd, 1994, at a Superstars taping in Ocean City, Maryland that aired on July 30th, Bret Hart pinned Bob Backlund with a small package to retain his WWE title. This was, and it's been years since I've seen it, but this was, as I recall, an awesome match. This was the best of all of the televised matches that these two had. I mean, their WrestleMania 11 match absolutely sucked. I wasn't even really a big fan of their Survivor Series. I mean, I like the story they told at Survivor Series in 94 with Owen and, you know, Bret trapped in the chicken wing for, I think it was in like 9 minutes or something. Owen trying to deceive his parents and his mom into throwing the towel into the ring. This was the best match that these two had. And very soon, you should be able to see it on Peacock, because they have Superstars episodes uploaded right now through, last I checked, I think it was May of 1994, or at least part of May of 94. And this is from the July 30th episode. So it looks like, they're uploading new Superstars in buckets of eight, which is not a lot. I mean, they used to put up like 20 new episodes at a time. Now they're doing like eight at a time. But before long, this episode should be up, and I encourage you all to watch the match if you've never seen it before. When it was over, Backlund was very upset, but he shook hands with Bret. And Bret then he made a cardinal mistake. He went in for a second handshake. And that is when Bob Backlund died and Mr. Backlund was born. He slapped the taste out of Bret's mouth. He locked on the crossface chicken wing. He refused to let go of the hold. On commentary, they couldn't even pull him off. On commentary, they said it's like he had the strength of 10 men. Finally, the referees pulled him off. Backlund just sat there on his knees staring at his hands like he couldn't believe what he had just done. This was the start of the Crazy Bob character. And he would go on to win the title from Bret at the Survivor Series before dropping it 3 days later to Diesel in 8 seconds in Madison Square Garden. Referee Joey Morella also worked the taping that night on what would turn out to be his final night. Morella was the adopted son of Gorilla Monsoon. He officiated two of the most iconic matches in WWE history in front of the two largest crowds in company history up to that point. Hulk Hogan against Andre the Giant at WrestleMania 3, and Bret Hart against Davey Boy Smith at SummerSlam from Wembley Stadium. After the show that night, he fell asleep at the wheel on the New Jersey Turnpike and was killed in a single car accident. He was only 31 years old. Mike Chioda talked about Morella last year on Talk is Jericho. He did an interview after he was released from WWE. And I was really happy at the time to hear him talk about Joey, because you don't really hear anybody talking about him anymore. I guess why would they? I mean, you don't have too many referees who are going out there who knew him doing interviews like this. So it was nice to hear him talk about it. It was sad to hear him talk about that night. Chioda said they had been on the road for 17 straight days. And he and Tony Chimmel invited Morella to come stay with them for the holiday, 4th of July. They're going to have a few days off finally. We can go hang out together. Joey wanted to visit his mother in New Jersey. And he was driving with downtown Bruno, Harvey Whippleman. Harvey had his seatbelt on. Joey did not. Joey dozed off, and he crashed right by the exit where his mother lived. Now, Whippleman survived, and Joey did not. And Kyoto said that he and Chimble, they drove past the accident that night, but they had no idea at the time that it was Joey. They said there were police cars and there were fire trucks everywhere. They slowed down to watch because that's what people do when they see a bad accident on the road. But it wasn't until the next morning that they found out it was Joey in that car. And the person who called to tell him? Gorilla Monsoon. 23 years ago this week, on June 28th, 1998, one of the most famous or infamous, depending on how you look at it, matches in wrestling history took place at the King of the Ring in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And it wasn't even originally supposed to happen. Mick Foley was coming off two straight pay-per-view matches with the new WWE champion, Steve Austin, both as the Dude Love character. Their Over the Edge match, one of my all-time favorites. These two guys were having so much fun recapping the end of that match on the latest Broken Skull sessions. Austin had beaten him decisively in that match, but according to Bruce Pritchard on his podcast, the King of the Ring match was supposed to be the third meeting with Austin and Foley. I don't know which face of Foley it would have been, but it would have been Austin and Foley again for the championship. But Vince McMahon wanted to do something different. He wanted to shake things up, which is what led to Austin having a First Blood match instead with Kane. Well, that left Mick Foley without an opponent. So Vince McMahon decided to match him up again with The Undertaker, even though the two of them had already had about five or six pay-per-view matches together, going back to 1996. When Foley found out that it would be inside Hell in a Cell, his words to Pritchard were, "How the hell do I top that?" He didn't think that there was anything he could do that would top what Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker did in the original. So he went to his mentor, he went to Terry Funk, for advice. And Terry half-jokingly suggested, "Well, why don't you guys start on top of the cell? And then let Undertaker go ahead and throw you off the top." Well, that's a dangerous thing, even jokingly. That is a dangerous thing to say to Mick Foley. He took the suggestion seriously and told Funk he thought he could do it. He just had to sell Undertaker and Vince McMahon on the idea first. And it took weeks of Undertaker saying, "No, no, absolutely not," before he finally relented. And it wasn't until he was actually up on top of the cage during the live pay-per-view that he cursed himself out and realized, "Oh shit, this is much higher than I thought." Because he hadn't gone up there until we saw him on top during the pay-per-view. Well, he gets up there, he looks down and says, "Ah, shit. This is higher than I thought." It was like a legit 16 feet up. But once he was up there, there was no turning back. And so off he went in one of the most iconic moments in WWE history, with Jim Ross providing the soundtrack as, "God is my witness, he is broken in half." Only to then climb back up the cage and be chokeslammed through the cell down to the canvas, which is so much worse than the bump through the Spanish announce table. I know that's the one that looks more spectacular. Like, that's the highlight reel bump. You see him, like, almost gracefully flying through the air, down through the announce desk. But that bump he took through the cell was so much worse. It was so much more brutal. Undertaker legitimately thought Foley was dead after that second bump. He hit with such force, and these were those old WWF rings. I think it was like a year or two later. They finally softened the rings a little bit. Once Vince McMahon started wrestling and taking bumps in the ring, I think is around the time, magically, the rings were no longer as hard as they used to be. But this was at a time when, I mean, they had almost no give to them. It was like falling on concrete. It was sickening. Terry Funk said that top part of the cell was rigged to sag a little bit. And I guess for dramatic effect, the idea was that Foley would then roll down to the mat. But everyone involved claims it was never supposed to completely give out the way that it did. Foley was knocked unconscious for a few seconds. He continued the match, though, including the thumbtack spot that he didn't even remember doing when the match was over. So there in the back, Foley asks Undertaker, "Did I use the thumbtacks?" And Undertaker had to tell him, "Dude, look at your damn arm." He still had tacks sticking in his arm. He didn't even realize it. It's the match that Mick Foley will always be remembered for. I can remember watching it with my father and just our shocked reactions when he went flying off in those first 90 seconds. You know, it's a hard match to grade. It's hard to grade it as a match. As a spectacle, the fucking thing, I mean, it gets 6 stars. As a match, you know, it depends. Everybody kind of looks at it differently. I still look at Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker in 97 as the best Hell in a Cell match of all the Cell matches they've ever done. This one, I look at it differently. It was so much more of a spectacle than any of the other Hell in a Cell matches. But as a match, you know, to me, I can't say that it's number one. Undertaker worked the match with bone chips in his foot, so he was hurting as well. I mean, not as much as Mick was when it was over, but both guys came out of this worse for wear. Foley, I'm sure, was severely concussed. How could he not be? How could he not be severely concussed? His jaw was dislocated. He had 3 teeth dislodged, one famously sticking out of his nose. His jaw was put back into place by Francois Petit, who was the first person you see scurry, the guy with the ponytail, scurrying into the ring, or into the cage to check on Mick after he fell into the ring. They billed him as WWE's medical doctor on TV, but in reality, he was a shiatsu masseuse for Vince McMahon and Steve Austin. And he also played the role of Sub-Zero in the first Mortal Kombat movie. Little trivia note for you. I met Foley 2 weeks after this match. They sent Foley, Owen Hart, Mark Henry, and Luna Vachon into our luxury box. I had won tickets from a radio station. My very first Monday Night Raw, Raw's War. I'm so excited. I'm the first one in the luxury box, so we get to get the front row. We open the window. And, you know, at the Meadowlands, you know, some arenas have luxury boxes like way, way, way up. These were like at the midway point. We had a great view of the ring, right? I'm in this great mood. And here come Owen and Foley and Henry and Luna. And, you know, as a younger fan, you're on cloud nine. You're like, holy shit, this is awesome, right? And I just remember, and Foley was nice at all, but I remember looking at Mick. He was wearing the Mankind stuff, but he didn't have the mask on. And you could just tell he was not in good shape. He was definitely in, let's just say, some degree of discomfort. I can't believe they didn't just tell him after that pay-per-view, hey, dude, take a month off. I mean, I don't think anybody would have said no if he had asked for time off, but, I mean, that's just not what you did back then. You didn't ask for time off. If you were hurt, you hit it. It's just what a lot of guys did. But there were other matches on that King of the Ring show, believe it or not. Ken Shamrock beat The Rock in the finals to become the first babyface King of the Ring since Bret Hart 5 years earlier. And in the main event, boy, these guys must have been watching that Hell in a Cell match going, fuck my life. How the hell are we supposed to follow that? Stone Cold Steve Austin defending the WWE Championship in a First Blood match against Kane. If Kane didn't win the title, he promised to set himself on fire, which sounds a little extreme. Although I appreciate them at least making the title feel important. Austin was in the hospital for about 3 days leading up to this pay-per-view with a staph infection in his elbow. You can see his elbow's all bandaged up when he comes out. Foley actually had to do a run-in in this match even after everything he had gone through. He ran as best he could down to the ring to get involved in the finish, which saw Austin get busted open and Kane announced as the new WWE champion. A shocking finish for those of us who thought Austin would have this long run as champion. But there was a method to the madness, as the next night on Raw, WWE drew its third highest rating in the history of the program for a show headlined by Kane, defending the title in a rematch against Steve Austin. Kane had all of 24 hours to enjoy his time as champion, as Austin regained the title. The show did a 5.3 Nielsen rating. The segment with the title change drew a 5.9 and a 10 share, good for more than 4.3 million viewers. The 3-minute overrun after Nitro had already gone off the air did a phenomenal 6.9 rating, in more than 5 million homes. It was all about the ratings back then. Even more so than today, it was all about the ratings back then. Today, they have their guaranteed TV money for the next few years, so they don't care. They don't care. And it shows, believe me, it shows, especially on Mondays, it shows. This episode of Raw also featured the debut of Steven Regal with a win over Darren Drozdov. It was one of the only TV, maybe the only TV appearance that Regal made before they sent him to a training camp to get into shape. This is when he was hooked on painkillers. He did not look good at all. And also the debut of the ill-fated Brawl for All tournament, with Steve Blackman beating Mark Mero and Bradshaw beating Henry Godwin. 22 years ago this week, on June 28th, 1999, it was the night after the King of the Ring ladder match where Vince and Shane McMahon won back control of WWE against Steve Austin. There was a briefcase hanging above the ring for that match, and a mystery person was raising it up higher and higher when Austin was about to grab it. I don't know if it was ever specifically stated that it was the Big Boss Man who was on the outs with the corporation at the time, but when he showed up on Raw the next night to his old Boss Man babyface music, by the way, it was all a swerve, and he hugged all of the corporate team members, so I assume it was him, or we're supposed to think it was him that did it. Austin, though, took out an insurance policy, he said, just in case that very thing happened, and I guess now he had the power to book himself in a WWE title match, which is exactly what he did on Raw as War against The Undertaker, who had a pretty bad match with The Rock the night before. I actually met The Rock for the first time the day before that King of the Ring pay-per-view at a car dealership in Brooklyn over on Utica Avenue. He did a signing, but I think it was a case where the person who owned the dealership had an in at WWE and knew somebody. It just was so out of, and I have pictures from this, it's so out of place. Like, it just literally, they dropped a table in the middle of this car dealership, and there's The Rock, you know, right before his big pay-per-view match for the championship with The Undertaker. But on this night, he had a better match with Stone Cold. That saw, Undertaker did, that is. He had a better match with Stone Cold than he did with The Rock the night before, which saw Austin become only the third man at that point in history to win the WWE title 4 times. The other two being Hulk Hogan and Bret Hart. It remains, to this day, the most watched wrestling match in the history of cable television. It scored an unbelievable 9.5 Nielsen rating and a 17 share. Nearly 1 in 10 homes with cable in this country were tuned into that match. That works out to be about 10.7 million viewers. Raw annihilated Nitro that night, 6.3 to 3.5. 2 days later, on June 30th, 1999, WWE on its website announced it had signed Chris Jericho to a 3-year contract at the same time that he was still technically under contract for another month to WCW. Jericho, months earlier, had already made the decision to leave for WWE. He wasn't happy with his position in WCW. He didn't see any real upward mobility. And in a funny note, considering how WWE does business these days, the July 12th edition of the Wrestling Observer noted that Jericho did have a 90-day non-compete clause in his WCW contract that should have technically prevented him from debuting there until October. But, and I quote, "Those non-compete clauses haven't been enforced in the past because of the question as to whether they would stand up in court, and he is expected to debut on WWF television in some form immediately after the contract expires." I don't know if that clause would apply, though, if the contract had just expired. You know, when WWE releases somebody early, they're still getting paid. And they have a standard, you know, 90-day clause. I think it's 30 days for NXT talent. But if the contract just runs out, I don't see how they can prevent you from working anywhere that you want. But that would definitely be something to challenge in court. So they didn't waste any time in announcing on their website that Jericho was coming in. And in the July 10th issue of the Pro Wrestling Torch, Wade Keller said the WCW did not aggressively pursue Jericho. His current deal paid him $225,000 a year, and they were planning to offer him a raise up to $450,000 a year for 3 years. The same deal they had offered Chris Benoit, Eddie Guerrero, and Dean Malenko, all of whom re-signed with the company. Now, Jericho had a verbal agreement with Eric Bischoff from over 6 months prior that he was going to re-sign, but when Bischoff dragged his feet on presenting him with the actual contract, Jericho took a secret meeting with Vince McMahon at his house in Connecticut and decided to renege on that verbal deal, which Bischoff was not happy about. Bruce Pritchard on his podcast said the idea of putting the announcement on their website was about beating the dirt sheets to the punch and making their website the main source of information for their audience instead of finding it somewhere else. Now, they tried a similar experiment years later where they started running stories on other promotions like TNA. They were trying to put the dirt sheets out of business, I guess. Yeah, that lasted all of a few weeks. 20 years ago this week, on July 2nd, 2001, Booker T wrestled Buff Bagwell for the WCW title in the main event of Monday Night Raw from Tacoma, Washington, in a match far more important than people may realize. It was the match that single-handedly killed the planned revival of the WCW brand after WWE had bought the company a few months earlier. WWE turned the main event of Raw that night into Nitro, basically, without calling it that. They put the WCW logo in the corner of the screen. They swapped out the ring skirt with a WCW logo skirt. They brought out WCW referee Nick Patrick to officiate the bout. They brought WCW announcer Scott Hudson to do commentary with Arn Anderson, who, you know, while he is a very good promo, he's a good talker. He had never called a match a day in his life before this. Stacy Keibler served as the ring announcer, and of all people to feature in this historic main event, they chose Buff Bagwell to challenge for the championship. The match itself was no good. Whatever was left of the 20,000 or so fans in the building that night at the Tacoma Dome, many of them had already taken to the exits. As soon as the main event started, people started leaving the building. The people that were left booed these guys out of the building. They chanted everything from boring, which was very jarring. Booker T has said that he had never been in that situation before where people chanted boring at him during his match. They were chanting boring. They were chanting this match sucks. They were chanting Goldberg, who wasn't even signed with the company at that time. It was billed as the most awkward match in WWE history by WWE.com back in 2013. These people, you gotta figure that these people in the building that night, they paid to see the stars of WWE. They paid to see Steve Austin. They paid to see Kurt Angle. They paid to see Chris Jericho. They paid to see The Undertaker. And for years, they had been conditioned to see WCW as the enemy. These are the bad guys. We're the good guys. All of a sudden, they're expected to cheer for two guys that a lot of them probably don't even know. Or if they knew Booker, they probably didn't know who Buff Bagwell was. 5 minutes in, Stone Cold Steve Austin and Kurt Angle, the two biggest heels in the company at the time, ran in to beat the crap out of Booker T, and you would have thought they were the two biggest baby faces, the way they were cheered. It was like, thank you for putting us out of our misery. They dragged Booker to the back. They threw him out of the building into the parking lot. Then they did the same with Buff, who had joined in the attack and thought, hey, we're all buddies now. He got tossed out of the building as well. And then a week later, he was fired and he never wrestled for them again. And that was the final nail in the coffin for WCW. But it wasn't supposed to be. For months, Jim Ross and Kevin Dunn, they were the point people. They were tasked with working on plans to run WCW as its own brand, coming up with a roster, booking towns to run in. You got to call these buildings months in advance to book these cities and to book these venues. A lot of that work, a lot of that legwork had already been done. But this was the plan. Coming out of the Invasion pay-per-view, there was going to be a divorce hearing on television with Vince McMahon and Linda McMahon. Their assets would be split right down the middle, with WWE being split into two groups, one of which would be WCW. And WCW would be led by Shane McMahon. They would get the Raw slot on Monday nights. Now, they had tried at first. They went to TNN, which is where, you know, Raw was airing at the time. They wanted a totally new time slot, I think on a Saturday night. And they wouldn't give it to them. Even though Raw was the number one rated show on the network, they were not giving them any more, you know, any new time slots. So the new plan was, we're going to give Raw to WCW, because at least Vince McMahon recognized that if we're going to make this work, we can't half-ass this. Raw is our baby. Raw is our flagship show. If this thing is going to have a shot at working, then we've got to go all in here. We'll give Raw to WCW. Raw will become the WCW show. WWE would get SmackDown. There would be a draft lottery to create the rosters for both shows, and the WCW show would end up with some big WWE names on it, because the feeling was, and I agree, that at least at first you needed to have some big WWE names on that show or it would fucking die. Whatever Raw was averaging at the time on television, I mean, that show was going to go down the fucking toilet unless you had stars, name people on the show that people knew. It was a necessary evil, even though, you know, you want to do a proper brand split with WWE and WCW and build to like a massive supercard. You really don't want to have that mixing of the brands like that. But again, you almost didn't have a choice. But this match and the fan reaction to the match killed WCW for good. The invasion angle was their plan B, and that didn't fare much better. And a side note, they did have plans to debut Jerry Lawler that night with Scott Hudson as the WCW announce team. They had a secret agreement with Lawler all worked out, but it fell apart when they sent Lawler a contract, but not his wife, the Cat, who was fired earlier that year, and that's when he walked out of the company with her. He was of the impression that she was going to have a deal coming out of this as well, and once he realized that wasn't the case, everything fell apart. When he pulled out, they went with Arn Anderson as the announcer because they didn't have anybody else. 19 years ago this week, on the July 1st, 2002 episode of Monday Night Raw, Jeff Hardy came within inches of becoming the Undisputed Champion in a memorable ladder match against The Undertaker. After it was over, Undertaker, who was the heel, paid respect to Jeff for the effort. He had done the same thing with John Cena on SmackDown after he made his debut like a week before this. He had endorsed John Cena, shook his hand in that backstage segment after Cena's loss to Kurt Angle. This was a period where they were attempting to give some credibility to some of the younger guys. And on the Raw 10th Anniversary Special the following year, this match was nominated for Raw Match of the Decade. And when WWE.com compiled a list of the 50 greatest matches in Raw history, they ranked this one at number 5. 18 years ago this week, on the June 30th, 2003 episode of Monday Night Raw, Gail Kim, in her debut appearance, won a Women's Battle Royal to win the Women's Championship, beating out Trish Stratus, Victoria, Ivory, Molly Holly, Jacqueline, and Jazz, who entered the match as the champion, but Jazz suffered a shoulder injury during the match and had to be carried to the back. I believe the plan was always for Gail Kim to win, unless the injury changed that. I don't think it did. I've never heard her in an interview say that it did. So a great way, you would think, right, to start out your career there. I'm winning the championship on my first night. Unfortunately, that was about as good as it ever got for Gail Kim in WWE. She was gone 2 years later, and then she returned to the company in 2009 before leaving for good in 2011, last working a battle royal where she was told, hey, make sure you are out of there in the first minute of the match. So she eliminated herself about 20 seconds in, and she walked, which I don't think is what they had in mind, although they did tell her to make sure she was out of there in the first minute, but she eliminated herself under the bottom rope, because back then with the women's battle royals, you know, any elimination through the ropes didn't have to be over the top. You were gone. And so it was only about 20 seconds in, and she went out under the bottom rope, and she walked to the back with Melina, who had also wrestled her final match for the company. She had just been eliminated. Melina, though, was released from the company about a week later. Gail was completely fed up with WWE by this point and them never doing anything serious with her. She said, fuck it. I wonder if they'll even notice. If I eliminate myself, I wonder if they will even notice. I don't think they did. I don't think anybody said anything to her. She walked to the back, and not long after that, she quit the company. Although I don't think they let her go, but I think her contract ran out about a month later anyway. So she started her run there in a battle royal, and she ended her run there in a battle royal. 16 years ago this week, on the July 4th, 2005 episode of Raw from Sacramento, California, Shawn Michaels and Hulk Hogan were victorious over Kurt Angle and Carlito. After the match, as they posed together, Michaels super-kicked Hogan in the face, turning heel and setting up the big Icon versus Icon match for SummerSlam, which Hogan won. And then the very next night, Michaels was back to being a babyface and started a program with Chris Masters. I so wish we would have gotten a proper heel run for Michaels, one that was longer than 6 weeks, but we never got another one again. 15 years ago this week, on July 3rd, 2006, Raw was live from Philadelphia with a triple threat match for the WWE Championship with Rob Van Dam defending against both Edge and John Cena. This was the first time the WWE title had changed hands on Raw in 5 years. Edge walked out with the championship that night, and the very next day, RVD would lose his ECW World Championship to the Big Show before being suspended for a month. So how did we get here? What happened here? The night before, Van Dam was riding with Sabu. They were going from one show to the next. They're driving down the road. They get stopped by an Ohio State trooper for speeding. When the troopers searched the vehicle, they found 18 grams of marijuana, 9 Teslac pills, which at the time was used to treat late-stage breast cancer, but also was used by steroid users to prevent breast growth, 5 Vicodin pills, and what was described as, quote, other drug paraphernalia. They were arrested. They later posted bond. Van Dam was hoping to keep the arrest quiet because Sabu's first suggestion was, we got to tell Vince. We got to call Vince. And Van Dam said, no, what the hell are you doing? What are you doing? No. He doesn't have to know. Nobody has to know. Meanwhile, once they got to the building, word had traveled fast. Vince McMahon knew and everybody knew what had happened. And plans were quickly made to get both belts off of him as quickly as possible and to suspend him. And Van Dam said that he was fined $100 by the company for possession of marijuana, but he estimates that the suspension ended up costing him around $40,000. And despite that, he claims that month off was one of the best months of his contract because he had grown so tired of being on the road so much, he saw it as a blessing. I hope that I can one day be successful enough to lose $40,000 and consider it a blessing. 13 years ago this week, on the June 30th, 2008 episode of Monday Night Raw. A lot of Raw history this week in history. CM Punk cashed in his Money in the Bank briefcase and pinned Edge to win the World Heavyweight Championship. This was right after Jim Ross had been drafted from Raw to SmackDown, so they had JR come out here in Oklahoma City and give a farewell speech, which was interrupted by Edge, who gloated about Raw having no champion, with Triple H having been drafted to SmackDown with the WWE title. Both belts were on the blue brand. And he said that he would never be appearing on Raw again after this, until the next draft. Batista came out. He beat the crap out of Edge, who had beaten him at Night of Champions 24 hours earlier. And with Edge laid out, that allowed Punk to cash in. He brought a referee down to the ring with him. The bell rang. He picked up Edge, gave him the GTS. And CM Punk brought the big gold belt back to the Raw brand. 12 years ago this week, on June 29th, 2009, two Mexican mini wrestlers, twin brothers Alberto and Alejandro Jimenez, both 34 years old, were found dead of an apparent overdose in a hotel room not far from Arena, Mexico. When WWE and AAA started working together in 1997, AAA sent a group of Mexican minis to work for WWE, some of whom were repackaged as mini versions of existing WWE stars. So, for example, if you were watching like I was back then, you might remember that we had mini Goldust, and we had mini Mankind, and we had mini Vader. I think those might have been the only three. They had other minis as well, but the ones who were kind of mimicking the WWE stars, those were the main ones. These two brothers were mini Mankind and mini Vader. After a show here, they were approached by two prostitutes. They went back to their hotel room with them. The ladies spiked their drinks with eye drops containing some kind of drug with the intent of robbing them of their wallets and their cell phones when they passed out, which they did. The women were part of a crime syndicate called La Flirtacion, which pulled this stunt before on other men. Usually their victims didn't die, but I guess due to how small they were, the drugs mixed with the drinks, that was enough to prove fatal. And a 44-year-old woman and a 65-year-old woman were later arrested and convicted of double murder, with each woman being sentenced to 47 and a half years in prison. 47 years just wasn't enough. They had to tack on that extra half a year just to make a point. 7 years ago this week, on June 29th, 2014, John Cena won a ladder match for the vacant WWE World Heavyweight Championship, winning his 15th world title at the Money in the Bank pay-per-view. Daniel Bryan was forced to surrender the title, noting that the strength was not coming back in one of his arms after surgery and that he may need another operation to address the issue. WWE did not want to, they didn't want the title on ice any longer, so he was stripped of it. And it was put up in a ladder match with Cena, Bray Wyatt, Alberto Del Dipshit, Randy Orton, Kane, Sheamus, Cesaro, and Roman Reigns. And Cena's win put him in line to defend the title against Brock Lesnar at SummerSlam, fresh off his ending The Undertaker's streak at WrestleMania. That spot was originally intended for Daniel Bryan. Daniel Bryan was going to be massacred by Brock Lesnar at SummerSlam, but Cena ended up in the spot instead, which I actually think had far more impact. I don't think it would have been nearly as shocking if it was anybody but Cena in that spot getting beaten as badly as he was. I suspect the fan reaction to that match would not have been nearly as favorable as it was were it Daniel Bryan getting annihilated instead of John Cena. I think people would have had a very different reaction to the match that night. Also on this show, Seth Rollins won the Money in the Bank ladder match just weeks after he turned on his Shield brothers and aligned with the Authority. He beat Dean Ambrose, Dolph Ziggler, Jack Swagger, Rob Van Dam, and Kofi Kingston to win the briefcase. Rollins would hold on to that thing until cashing in at WrestleMania 31 in the main event. A few days later, on July 2nd, Tennille Dashwood, then known as Emma, was fired by WWE after being arrested days earlier and charged with shoplifting a $21 iPad case from a Walmart in Hartford, Connecticut. WWE has come to terms on the release of WWE diva Emma as of today, July 2nd, 2014. WWE wishes Emma the best in all her future endeavors. That was the announcement. Her lawyer said that she bought $30 worth of items at a self-checkout machine and simply forgot to scan the case. And employees at the Walmart later confirmed that she did pay for all of the items save for the iPad case, which was, quote, improperly scanned. She was ordered by the court to perform one day of community service, take an online course, and then the charge was dismissed. Within hours of firing her, WWE reversed course and rehired her amid fan backlash over how they would fire her after not doing the same to Jack Swagger or Cameron of the Funkadactyls, who had been arrested previously on DUI charges. The company said in a statement, upon further evaluation, WWE has reinstated Tennille Dashwood, WWE diva Emma, but will take appropriate punitive action for her violation of the law. I love it. Yes, they will take away her iPad and force her to use an Android tablet instead. You can think of nothing worse. And finally, 6 years ago this week on July 4th, 2015, WWE aired a live network special from Sumo Hall in Tokyo, Japan called The Beast in the East, built around Brock Lesnar wrestling Kofi Kingston for the first time. This went only marginally better for Kofi than their second match did. At least this one lasted longer than 8 seconds. And Finn Balor won the NXT Championship from Kevin Owens in an excellent match. I know Balor had a big following in Japan before coming to WWE, but I remain convinced, and I said this back then and I still believe this to this day, I remain convinced that had he not gotten injured a couple of months earlier, it would have been Kenta as Hideo Itami, winning the title that night from Owens and not Balor. Kenta never did get his big moment. And that is this week. This very busy week. They all seem very busy, but this one especially busy. In wrestling history. Email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter, @solomonster is my handle on there. Don't forget, WrestleRumble.com, the custom Solomonster Championship belt contest, the big giveaway. Coming up in just a few weeks, we're going to be giving away one custom Solomonster replica belt. After my money, or during, I should say, my Money in the Bank recap on July 18. It's only $1 to enter. You can enter as many times as you want. Go to WrestleRumble.com to get in on that contest. I want one of you guys. I want it to be one of you listening to this right now that wins that belt. The only way to do that is to get in on the contest. Listen, I hope you guys have a very enjoyable 4th of July. Those of you here stateside who are celebrating, stay safe. I say it every year because I used to live next to somebody who was an emergency room doctor, and she would tell me horror stories about working the night shift on July 4th and all the people who would walk in with fingers missing and various injuries because they didn't know what the fuck they were doing when they were setting off fireworks. So if you're doing any of that shit, just be safe and be smart and enjoy the holiday. I will be back with you for episode 712 next Sunday, and of course this Wednesday live on YouTube for AEW Dynamite Back on the Road. That should be a lot of fun. Dynamite in Miami. Join me live on YouTube Wednesday night back in our usual slot. And if you want to become a YouTube channel member, we got more content coming for our channel members on there. Plus you get Discord access. Go to youtube.com/thesolomonster. Hit that join button. It'll give you all the details there. I think that about covers it. Guys, happy 4th. Be well. Stay safe. I'll see you back for 712 next Sunday. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solomonster sounds off.
What is the point of Tony Schiavone even coming down to the ring to do these interviews if every single time they pull the microphone out of his hand? There were a couple of AEW diehards who got very upset. Oh my God, you're criticizing. But these will be the first fucking people. If WWE did something like this, oh, they'd be online. Oh my God, WWE, look at this. What a shit product. God forbid you say something negative about AEW. Holy shit. The world is just falling down all around us. You people gotta cool your jets. Don't tell me what to tweet on my Twitter. You can go fuck yourself.
The Solomonster Sounds Off, available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesolomonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow the Solomonster on Twitter @Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Put that cigarette out.
Solomonster Sounds Off.